The question for the night is, will technology save or destroy us? To which I think the answer is probably yes. And that said, I would like to try and think about some of what that means. Because we live for better and for worse in a technological society, which means that much of who we are and much of what we are has been dramatically amplified. Our potential to heal and do good and our capacity to hurt and inflict suffering have both reached unprecedented levels at one and the same time. We can cure disease and despoil the earth. We can talk to and comfort people on the other end of the globe, and some of us, at least, can also obliterate people without so much as getting out of a chair. So in some deep way, we remain always who we have been, only more so. Creatures legitimately capable of building worlds and destroying them. By the way, the Torah, I think, is preoccupied with this idea. Already in Genesis 4, the Torah makes, in its characteristically subtle way, the point that the great paragon of progress, Cain, the same person who invents cities, also invents murder. Right? Human power, human potential is multivalent, cuts in both ways, is a double-edged sword. The Torah already, I think, tries to make that point. But now I'd like to take back what I just said, because I'm not actually sure that technology merely amplifies who we are. In fact, and you can look at the sort of opening quote on your sheets, the British philosopher George Patterson writes the following: technology is not just something that mediates between our mental intentions and the physical world about us. Technology gets inside our heads and affects the very way in which we conceive reality. I want to try to spend tonight thinking a little bit about what that actually means. Technology is not just a way of getting things done, but actually who we are is radically transformed by the fact of living in a technological culture. So by engaging with the thinking of Rabbis Abraham Joshua Heschel and Joseph Soloveitchik, I want to try to ask directly and indirectly three questions. First, how does technology shape and reshape who we are and how we are in the world? How does it shape and reshape our minds as well as our hearts? And how does it broaden our vision? And how does it constrict it or distort it? And in order to talk about that, I want to start with a few sentences about Martin Heidegger. Now, as a footnote, since I can't give a talk without footnotes, Martin Heidegger, one day someone will write a fantastic book about how Martin Heidegger is this amazing kind of colossus in 20th century Jewish thought, where all 20th century Jewish thinkers are essentially grappling with Heidegger while struggling with whether they should even admit it, because they think that he's one of the great philosophers of the 20th century, arguably the greatest philosopher of the 20th century, and also one of the worst human beings of the 20th century, which is in itself sort of a jarring thing to wrestle with, right? An enormously important philosopher and theorist of modernity and critic of modernity, and essentially an unrepentant Nazi. And yet, Heschel and Soloveitchik and Buber and pretty much everyone else who's engaged with the Western canon is constantly wrestling with Heidegger. And Heidegger, in many ways, is the great theorist and critic of technological culture. So Martin Heidegger argued that technologically has dramatically altered the ways we interact with the world. Because, he says, in the modern world, we are trained to focus on what he calls calculative thinking. I'll explain what that means in a second. We imagine that everything is a resource available for manipulation and exploitation. We come to see the world as material to be used, and not as something to be confronted, encountered, or valued. Everything becomes a resource. Or as he puts it in probably one of his most famous sentences, in the modern world, nature becomes a gigantic gasoline station, an energy source for modern technology and industry. Now, is he overstating his case? Look for a moment, if you would, at the first source on your page. This is from a book by a contemporary philosopher named Richard Holt, who writes an introduction to Martin Heidegger. And I love this paragraph, which I think is really interesting. He says, when we look at today's language, we can see that there is something to what Heidegger is saying. Natural things are routinely called natural resources. Human beings are human resources. Books and artworks become information resources. And writing becomes word processing, as if language, too, were just a resource to be manipulated. And I would submit to you, if your reaction to that is that that's clever, is that I think he's actually saying something extremely profound. The way we talk about everything we encounter as something to use. So it's crucial to emphasize, and this is really important to hold this distinction in mind as we go, that the problem for Heidegger is not technology. The problem is the technological way of seeing the world, right? There's nothing wrong with a computer. There's something wrong with how a culture preoccupied with technology comes to see the world. It is about a way of looking, and we'll try to explain what that means as we go. And why is it so dangerous to see the world through a technological culture? Because, right, if we focus exclusively on exploiting and manipulating the world, on getting what we want, we lose, in Heidegger's formulation, any sense of openness and receptivity. We lose all sensitivity to meaning, to transcendence. This was enormously influential on Abraham Joshua Heschel. This is a theme he comes back to again and again. His understanding of modernity is deeply influenced by Heidegger, with one major difference, which is what makes him such a quintessentially Jewish thinker. For Heschel, what is most dangerous about technological culture is that I lose my openness to God and to other people. In other words, the danger is both ethical and theological. For Heidegger, I lose my mystical connection to being. And if you're not sure what that means, you're in very good company, right? But there's some kind of relationship to the world that is lost. Heidegger was not a thinker who spent a lot of time prioritizing the ethical, to say the least, despite what some of my students would like to argue. Abraham Joshua Heschel learned a lot from him, but he also tried very hard to move beyond him. So I want to try to spend the bulk of our time right now understanding what Heschel has to say about technological modernity. I think that if you asked Abraham Joshua Heschel, what is the thing you most want to say to the modern world? What is the lesson that you, as a philosopher, as a rabbi, as a spiritual teacher, want to say? I have a feeling one of the two main things would have been this, that there are two ways of being in the world. Life is a struggle from moment to moment between self-assertion on the one hand, the impulse to say I, and self-transcendence on the other, the focus on you. Crucially for Heschel, I really want to underline what I said, this is a moment-to-moment struggle. No one ever fully transcends. There's no such thing as a self-transcended person. I always tell students, this is probably a little bit offensive, but I always tell students, if you ever encounter a spiritual teacher who talks about having transcended his ego, because it's always a he who says this, you should always be careful about A, where's your wallet, B, where's your daughter? Because people like that are either con men or deluded, right? It's extremely important for Heschel to say, it's extremely important, this is a moment-to-moment struggle, right? And if that sounds abstract, just think about moments in your own life where you are totally able to respond to another person, you are totally responsive and giving, and the very next moment you think to yourself, wow, it's amazing. 3 minutes ago I was totally wonderful, and now look how horribly I just treated that other person. Or, not so dissimilarly, you find yourself doing an act of kindness, and then all of a sudden you notice that your act of kindness is a giant act of self-congratulation. Aren't I wonderful? Right? You can tell nobody here knows what I'm talking about, right? But so this is you can look, by the way, if you want to see that, you can look at sources 1 and 2 in Heschel, which we won't read together. This is, he says, a basic fact of the human condition. There are two ways of living in and responding to the world. He calls these the way of wonder, which is what self-transcendence is, and the way of expediency, which is what self-assertion is. What is wonder? Wonder is the realization that none of this had to be. I did not earn my life. I did not earn consciousness. I did not earn the existence of the world, and yet there it is. And when I realize how much I've been given, I feel both grateful and indebted, and I have the urge to repay. the way of expediency is essentially about entitlement. It's mine, and I want more. Rather than giving, I want to take, to acquire, to possess, and you can fill in whatever words make most sense to you there. This distinction is really fundamental to Heschel's worldview and to his understanding of religion. If you look for one moment at the last sentence in source 4, I'm going to go out of order for a second. He says, the last two sentences, sorry. We go out to meet the world not only by way of expediency, but also by way of wonder. In the first, we accumulate information in order to dominate. In the second, we deepen our appreciation in order to respond. Right? This is part of what Heschel means when one of his most important sentences, I think, when he says, mankind will not perish for want of information, but for want of appreciation. Right? So the way of expediency, of self-assertion, closes us off to what is outside us. The way of wonder, in contrast, awakens us to the reality that he calls living in the great fellowship of all beings. It is all about connectedness. What does all this have to do with the modern world? Heschel thinks that the way of wonder and the way of expediency always lie open before us. They are sort of endemic to the human condition. But modernity takes the way of expediency and amps it up, places it on steroids, threatens to eliminate the possibility of wonder altogether. In modernity, human beings become tool-making animals, and that becomes the definition of what it means to be human. A major reason this is the case, probably the major reason this is the case, according to Heschel, is the culture of technology. When Heschel wants to ask, where has the modern world gone off the rails? He says that the fundamental problem at bottom that underlies everything else is that we have come to see the world not as a wonder and a marvel, but as a giant opportunity to get what we want. And look at source 3, which is basically a paraphrase of Heidegger. Our age is one in which usefulness is thought to be the chief merit of nature. Man has become primarily a tool-making animal, and the world is now a gigantic toolbox for the satisfaction of his needs. In other words, expediency rules the day. The modern question is not, how can I respond, but how can I use this? Look at source 4. Most of our attention is given to the expedient, to that which is conducive to our advantage and which would enable us to exploit the resources of our planet. If our philosophy were a projection of man's actual behavior, we would have to define the value of the earth as a source of supply for our industries and the ocean as a fish pond. That is basically an allusion for those who are following him to Heidegger. He basically says, I don't understand. What? The fact is we live as if we don't believe that anything has intrinsic value other than in the way it can serve us. But why does wonder die? Well, on one level, wonder dies in a way that all of us can recognize. Wonder dies through routine. Wonder dies because I do the same thing over and over and over again, and it becomes stale. This is one of the great paradoxes at the heart of Judaism as a religion, that what is supposed to keep wonder alive is a fixed practice of prayer. Right? Something paradoxical and strange about that, difficult. But much worse, much more dangerous, Heschel thinks, than routinization of our lives, which was true everywhere at all times, is instrumentalization of our lives. That is, we worship at the altar of expediency and ask again and again how the world can serve us. Now, I don't want to get lost in this, but I do think it's interesting. Heschel argues, in a way that I think is really fascinating, that the culture of technology is actually a boomerang. If you look at source 5, he who sets out to employ the reality of life as means for satisfying his own desires will soon forfeit his freedom and be degraded to a mere tool. In other words, you can't turn everything else into an instrument without thereby turning yourself into an instrument also. Another way of saying that that's maybe less abstract, you can't treat everything else as having no intrinsic value and still ultimately imagine that you alone have intrinsic value. You become consumed by your own method of seeing the world. Acquiring things, man becomes enslaved to them. In subduing others, he loses his own soul. It is as if unchecked covetousness were double-faced, a sneer and subtle vengeance behind a captivating smile. And then one more, my view of the world and my understanding of the self determine each other. The complete manipulation of the world results in the complete instrumentalization of the self. But here's where it gets interesting and why it's important to talk about this here. In the culture of technology, Heschel argues, even religion is valued because it serves me. Even religion is valued because it serves me. And to give a contemporary example of this that I spend a lot of time thinking about, notice how common it has become for popular Jewish teachers to talk about Judaism as a technology. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you should be grateful. But very common way of talking, right? Jewish ritual is a spiritual technology. What happens when you say that is essentially you're asking, how can religion serve me? Lately, I've seen rabbis talk about the problem of American Judaism is poor delivery systems, right? The sound you hear is Heschel pulling the hair out of his head, right? Because the problem of that is, instead of asking how Judaism or some other religious tradition can serve you, let's try to talk about how Judaism can teach us that life is not about being served. What happens is that American religious teachers all the time convince themselves that the best way to sell religion to Americans is to talk in the language that they think those Americans want to be talked to. And lo and behold, what happens is the teachers become more like the culture they claim to want to change than, in fact, they change the culture. And this runs so deep. I think of an example of a recent, very lovely book in many ways about kind of an American popularization of Mussar, about, you know, attempt to be more ethically sensitive, aware of other people, and the introduction ends with the sentence, something like, hope I'm not misrepresenting this, and so I invite you to ask how Mussar can serve you. It's an amazing formulation. It sort of gives away the game. Instead of, I invite you to consider how Mussar can change your question and restore the real question behind religion, which is not how can this serve me, but how can I serve? Look at source 7, if you would, for a minute. The essence of religion does not lie in the satisfaction of a human need. As long as man sees religion as a source of satisfaction for his own needs, it is not God whom he serves, but his own self. Right? That is to say, the question ultimately is, do we worship in religion a God who blesses our comforts or a God who tears our selfishness to shreds? That on some level is the religious question. Right? God does not exist to bless bourgeois comfort. That's just not what God is. That's the modern technological God. So according to Heschel, in all this relentless self-assertion has made, so he argues, unprecedented callousness and cruelty possible. And that is what has brought humanity such unimaginable devastation. Because, in other words, I think what it means is, if nothing else outside of me has any intrinsic value except for how it can serve me, then no one else outside me has any value except for how they can serve me. And if they can't serve me, so much the worse for them. There was a moment, I don't know if people still talk about this, in sociology and dealing with genocide, where people used to talk about surplus peoples, right? Peoples who no longer serve the purpose for the people in power. And lo and behold, if you don't serve a purpose for me, I'll obliterate you. So what Heschel thinks his job is to reorient us so that we realize that life is not about claims I make so much as it is about responding to claims made upon me. God in search of man, by the way, is simply Heschel's translation of the word Ayekah. Where are you? The opening question of the Bible. A question not by us, but to us. That's what religion is. Right? He wonderfully says at one point, right, philosophy of religion is a set of questions about God. Religion is a set of questions from God. Where all of a sudden, I am not the addresser, but I am the addressed. Obviously, this is not an empirical description of the history of religion. This is a vision of what religion could be in the world and ought to be. He argues, I think he actually just assumes, that this systematic reorientation from claims I make to claims made upon me is what is most distinctive and urgent about religion. And it's why he thinks religion is indispensable if modern people are to overcome their imprisonment within the culture of expediency and self-assertion. Obviously, we can wrestle with what do we do in a world where religion just makes all those things worse, right? But again, Heschel is articulating here a vision of how he thinks religion could work, should work, might yet work. Once again, I just want to reiterate this before we leave Heschel behind. The problem is not technology. The problem is the technological way of looking at the world. This is essentially his argument for why Shabbat is so urgent in modernity, because Shabbat is about refusing the instrumentalization of the world. I'm not allowed to use things. I'm not allowed to transform them according to my own ends. Look at source 9. The solution of mankind's most vexing problem will not be found in renouncing technical civilization, but in attaining some degree of independence of it. By the way, I just want to mention, and then I want to think about how different Soloveitchik is, that even theology in modern times often becomes, for philosophers, God is invoked all the time in modern philosophy as an attempt to solve my philosophical problems. What is God in Immanuel Kant's system? The guarantor that my moral striving has a proper end, right? So all kinds of postmodern Christian philosophers make fun of this by talking about, all caps, the God who makes our systems work, right? The God who answers my philosophical problems. God gets stipulated as an answer to my questions, which becomes yet another way of not allowing God to be the one who asks me questions. God is a tool or a hypothesis we use to make sense of our reality. Heschel says, that's not religion, that's something else. So in light of everything I just said, which is not so rosy and optimistic, it's very jarring to open up Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik's book, Halachic Man. And I want to just say, American Jews who are aware of Halachic Man think it's a book from the 1980s. Because that's when JPS put out an English translation and it won the National Jewish Book Award. But Halachic Man was written in 1944, which makes it even stranger in many ways as a book. And I'll try to explain why. Halachic Man is not explicitly about technology at all, but its second part is about something deeply related. It is about the idea of the human being being created to become a creator, being destined to be a creator. That is, for Soloveitchik, the primary meaning of being created in the image of God. Just as God is a creator, so too are we created to be creators. This becomes explicit later in The Lonely Man of Faith. What it means to be B'Tselem Elohim, to be in God's image for Soloveitchik is, I was made to be a builder and a creator. By extension, of course, that's also the meaning for Soloveitchik of walking in God's ways, of imitatio Dei. That is, just as God is a world creator, so also should I be. Now, Soloveitchik does this in a really interesting way. In the Misnagdic learning tradition from which he came, there was a tremendous preoccupation with generating new things, new insights in the world of Torah learning, chidushim. And one of Soloveitchik's greatest insights, I think one of his greatest revolutionary modern moves, is to insist that what is true in the Beit Midrash, in the study hall, ought to be true in the world writ large. If Torah, Judaism, cares about the world, then just as I am called upon to be creative in learning Torah, I am also called to be creative in a biolab. And it's merely an extension of the fundamental insight. Not everyone agrees that that's what Soloveitchik is saying in Halachic Man. I for one, am pretty confident that that is what he's saying. Now, you can look at source 1, where he lays that out, and then let's look at source 2 together for a minute. A really amazing sentence. Many Jews would say a heretical sentence. Halachic man discerns in every divine pledge man's obligation to bring about its fulfillment. In every promise, a specific norm. In every eschatological vision, an everlasting commandment. The commandment to participate in the realization of the prophecy. That is, anytime Judaism has a dream or a divine promise of how the world will one day be, we are implicated in trying to make that real. Now, I would just like to mention something that I think is interesting, which maybe is not even the heart of this lecture, but it is amazing. If you were to ask the Satmar Rebbe, give me a sentence that sums up what is satanic about Zionism and Jewish modernity, he would have quoted this sentence, right? That is to say, what are you talking about, right? Classical Jewish texts believe that when God makes a promise, so the Satmar Rebbe argues, what I'm supposed to do is have faith and wait. Where do you read in the prophets that Jeremiah, the last chapters of Isaiah, Isaiah articulates a dream, and what we should do is turn that into a concrete political program? Really? Right? Soloveitchik is more gifted than anyone I have ever read in simply saying completely radical, innovative things as if they're sort of matter-of-fact true. Right? This is only a modern could have written this sentence. Right? But it's an amazing sentence. What it says is it's all about our agency. We are called upon not just to create worlds, but on some level to redeem them, to make them perfect. I have often been tempted, this is like, you know, turn the recorder off, but I've often been tempted to give this sentence when I teach in yeshivot out of context and see how many people say, Zerav reform me. Right? This is totally like classic liberal theology. God says something, we do it. Right? So basically says, no, this is what Judaism says. Now, this is because his theology is driven by a vision of the human being as creator. He thinks, in other words, maybe I wouldn't have said it in those words before modernity, but he wants to argue that's implicit in Genesis 1. Human beings are made to be world builders. So what that means is that when God tells us, however you understand what that sentence means, but when God tells us what the world is supposed to look like, I'm implicated in making that happen. And I included, just for your reading interest, the next three passages, 3, 4, and 5, just to see how he develops that idea of the human being as a creator. Now, I imagine Soloveitchik reading Heschel, for that matter Heidegger too, on technology and saying, wait a minute, can everyone just calm down for a minute? We were meant from creation to be creators. Technology makes us able, in new and unprecedented ways, to do just that. For the first time, we can cure cancer. What are you schreien gewalt all day about? Why are you doing that? Don't you understand? For the first time, we can fully realize our humanity. We can create worlds. We can redeem worlds. What is so striking about halachic man, and frankly, as I already mentioned, given that it's written in 1944, what is so jarring about it is how optimistic it is. It's a very odd thing to be writing in 1944. It's almost like in Soloveitchik's world, the Holocaust has not, which is not uncommon among European thinkers, it has not really registered yet. On some level, this book registers none of the darkness of the time that it's being written in. It is almost impossibly optimistic. The later Soloveitchik is all about dialectics, is all about the sense of the willingness to embrace defeat and surrender. None of this is in Halachic Man. And in fact, it's fascinating. When I first started teaching Halachic Man in this yeshiva 10 years ago, I would have students from yeshiva day schools, and I would read Halachic Man, and they would say, but where's the stuff about self-sacrifice? Not in this book, right? It's just that your teachers all read his later essays and so assume Soloveitchik means sex. But here it's total optimism. Human beings are world creators. And let's get to it. Let's get to it. And Heschel, with all due respect, you need to get a grip, right? Because after all, right, modernity facilitates human agency. Of course, you can imagine what Heschel would say back, right? Yes, you're right. We can, in fact, build cancer wards. But we can also build gas chambers and nuclear bombs. Heschel is one of the first Jewish thinkers, and in a way that I think is actually intended to be subversive, to talk about Auschwitz and Hiroshima as a phrase over and over again. I don't know if that's a kind of veiled polemic against an obsession with the uniqueness of the Shoah. I'm not sure what's going on there. But over and over again, he sees those two, I don't want to say images, because they are excruciating realities, but he sees those as like, this is what modernity makes possible. You want to talk about cancer wards, you talk about cancer wards. But you can't talk about them without also talking about what technology has made possible, right? Our barbarism has reached unimaginable heights, and modernity makes that possible. So what is troubling about the younger Soloveitchik, in other words, is that he does not so much as gesture to the fact that just as quickly as we can become creators, we can become destroyers, and that the two are intertwined. That, after all, is what technology means. Technology gives people more power, right? That's actually just what it is. It means that every time you say to human beings, now you have the capacity to be more of a creator, it means that at the very same time you are saying, now you have the capacity to be more of a destroyer. Unlike the Soloveitchik of halachic man, many modern thinkers have wrestled with the ways that human freedom is actually curtailed by and not just expanded by technology. As one contemporary philosopher puts it, just a sentence I wish we had time to unpack because I think it's fascinating, we are at the mercy of unprecedented and unnatural forces that have been unleashed by our hubris or simply by lack of care, by which he means something like, imagine you and I decided, I don't know, take your pick, nuclear energy is not worth the effort. Global capitalism is not worth the project. Whatever you want to pick, right? So let's put a stop to it. How would I do that? Right? What I've created, what we've created, is much more powerful than we are. And philosophers of technology often talk about exactly this. We have to find ways to think about the ways that we congratulate ourselves for our power to create things. But what technology and modernity does is create, enable us to create things that then we no longer have any power to control. I think that is, by the way, overstated, but really important. So in other words, as often, Heschel and the Soloveitchik of halachic man are best read as counterpoints to each other, as dialectical counterweights to each other, if you will, right? Soloveitchik says, look what we can do. And Heschel says, I know, I'm looking, right? Look what we can do. And that's the dilemma. That's the rub of technological modernity. Now, in the interest of time, I don't want to say this at any length, but Soloveitchik later writes a book, The Lonely Man of Faith, which I would describe as a far more mature work of philosophy, right? And I want to just share a couple of pieces of a much larger, more complex book. In that book, Soloveitchik argues very passionately that the person of faith is to some degree always out of place in modern, secular, technological society. Look, if you would, for a second at source 6. Adam the first, that is, the human being as creator, is interested in just a single aspect of reality and asks one question only. How does the cosmos function? He is not fascinated by the question, why does the cosmos function at all? Nor is he interested in the question, what is the essence? He is only curious to know how it works. In fact, even this how question with which Adam the first is preoccupied is limited in scope. He is concerned not with the question per se, but with its practical implications. Adam 1, the human being as creator, is always focused on the concrete. How can I make this work? What can it do for me? He raises not a metaphysical, but a practical, technical how question. Adam the first is overwhelmed by one quest, namely, to harness and dominate the elemental natural forces and to put them at his disposal. This practical interest arouses his will to learn the secrets of nature. He is completely utilitarian, what I called before instrumental. He is completely utilitarian as far as motivation, teleology, design, and methodology are concerned. In other words, the human being as creator, what Soloveitchik calls Adam 1, is all about control, domination, manipulation, use, exploitation, whatever words you want to use there. But in contrast, Adam 2, who is sort of the person, the dimension of us that Soloveitchik introduces as he gets older, is all about appreciation, receptivity. Look for a moment, if you would, at source 7. Adam the second does not apply the functional method invented by Adam the first. He does not create a world of his own. Instead, he wants to understand the living, given world into which he has been cast. Therefore, he does not mathematize phenomena or conceptualize things. He encounters the universe in all its colorfulness, splendor, and grandeur, and studies it with the naivete, awe, and admiration of the child who seeks the unusual and wonderful in every ordinary thing and event. You almost wonder if he's read God in Search of Man and won't use the word wonder, right? Because what he's talking about here is exactly that, right? While Adam the first is dynamic and creative, transforming sensory data into thought constructs, Adam the second is receptive and beholds the world in its original dimensions. To oversimplify too much, Adam 1 is obsessed with the quantitative, Adam 2 restores the qualitative. So Adam 1 and Adam 2 for Soloveitchik have incommensurate ways of seeing the world. not just what they do, but how they see, what they see when they encounter the world day to day. Adam 1 sees, how can I harness this? How can I use this? How can this be brought to a purpose that I have for it? And Adam 2 marvels. This is amazing. This is valuable inherently, regardless of any encounter I have with it. Soloveitchik argues really beautifully there that Adam 1 forms communities, but they are really only communities dedicated to furthering interests. We might say, to borrow the language of another great Jewish philosopher, they are communities that are entirely I-it. They're about how I use things or people. They're not community in the deepest sense, because community in the deepest sense involves sacrifice and, crucially, making space for others. It's not self-assertion, in other words. And Soloveitchik has this wonderful image, which I wish we could talk about for a long time, but I just want to sort of share this. He says that he argues that human dignity lies in agency, in our ability to do things and make them happen. But human redemption lies in self-control, in the willingness to step back and not use all the power that I have. In some ways, you could argue that technological ethics is essentially one giant fight about when should I not use the power that I have, right? That is on some level, right? If you think about, you know, debates between certain kinds of conservatives in medical ethics and liberals, it's all about this. It's exactly about this question. Given that there's certain things I should not do, what are they? Wonderfully, Soloveitchik calls this, Adam 1 lives in a community of interests, Adam 2 lives in a community of commitments. So, to be clear, both Adam 1 and Adam 2 are crucial. It is not about overcoming Adam 1. Soloveitchik would never countenance the idea that human beings should give up the divine mandate to be creators. But nor should we be deluded into thinking all we are supposed to do is create without trammels, without limits, without stopping. We also are asked to appreciate, respond, and acknowledge limitation. And in fact, he argues, you know, as only he could, right, that halakha, his reading of the Jewish legal tradition, is that it mandates both at the same time. For another lecture in another year, one of the most interesting, I think, moments in all Soloveitchik's writing is where the end of Lonely Man of Faith, he seems to entertain for a brief moment that actually they don't need to be held in tension, they can be reconciled and held together. That's maybe a different topic. But when Soloveitchik then talks about religion, if you look at Source 9, he sounds just like Heschel. Notwithstanding the fact that Western man is in a nostalgic mood, he is determined not to accept the dialectical burden of humanity. He certainly feels spiritually uprooted, emotionally disillusioned, and like the old king of Ecclesiastes, is aware of his own tragedy. Yet this pensive mood does not arouse him to heroic action. He, of course, comes to a place of worship. He attends lectures on religion and appreciates the ceremonial. Yet he is searching not for a faith in all its singularity and otherness, but for religious culture. This is a fabulous takedown of American Judaism, by the way. No, I'm not trying to say obnoxiously. It's an amazing, right? What Jews are searching for is not religion, but religious culture. Kiddush. You laugh, but you know exactly what I'm talking about, right? I don't go to the shul. The chelent is fantastic. As opposed to, you know, the God shattered my selfishness. He seeks not the greatness found in sacrificial action, but the convenience one discovers in a comfortable, serene state of mind. He is desirous of an aesthetic experience rather than a covenantal one, of a social ethos rather than a divine imperative. I come to shul to talk to Goldberg, right? You all know that famous joke, right? Goldberg comes to shul to talk to God. I come to shul to talk to Goldberg, right? In a word, this is a young crowd, man. That was the most famous American joke, Jewish joke ever. In a word, the current American Jewish version is, I don't come to shul, but in a word, he wants to find in faith that which he cannot find in his laboratory or in the privacy of his luxurious home. His efforts are noble, but he is not ready for a genuine faith experience, which requires the giving of oneself unreservedly to God, who demands unconditional commitment, sacrificial action, and retreat. Western man diabolically insists on being successful. Alas, he wants to be successful even in his adventure with God. If he gives himself to God, he expects reciprocity. He also reaches a covenant with God, but this covenant is a mercantile one. In a primitive manner, he wants to trade favors and exchange goods. This is, by the way, one of the most amazing paragraphs in all of modern Jewish thought, I think. It is withering in many ways. So, the argument essentially of the lonely man of faith is, I don't disagree with what I said in Halachic Man. Our work in creating worlds is divinely sanctioned. And yet, without some other way of seeing, without some other way of encountering, I become unbearably impoverished and also dangerous. So, where does all of this leave us? I want to try to share a few summary thoughts in lieu of a real conclusion, because I can't figure out how to conclude this. And here I'll try to speak a little bit in my own voice. I think we can say, so let me say this first. I think we can say with great confidence that what has come to be called techno-utopianism is almost comically unserious. Techno-utopianism, for those of you who don't know, is a way of talking about ideologies that insist that advances in science and technology will eventually lead us to utopia. Such ideologies, I think, are unserious and extremely lazy because technology does not transform our natures for the good. As I suggested earlier, it amplifies who and what we already are. I would say it like this. Unless and until there is an app that heals jealousy, or a gadget that soothes feelings of national resentment and humiliation, unless there is a machine that ventilates our passion for violence, technology will not save us, and it is morally unserious to play at the idea that it will. More than that, right? Techno-utopianism is based on the illusion that human beings are capable of liberating ourselves from the human condition. And here, Jewish theology has always had the profoundly sobering response, perhaps God can do that. Although Maimonides was always quick to say, the very thought of doing that is inherently nonsense. It simply doesn't make any sense. But other Jewish thinkers have said, perhaps God can do that, but you can't. Beware of anyone who thinks they've transcended human nature. Beware of any human beings who think they can redeem the world. I give to you Joseph Stalin, right? The human pretension to utterly redeem reality ends up in barbarism over and over and over again. So techno-utopianism, I don't think, is really worth our time. But second, technology does not, in fact, as we've seen, merely amplify who already are, right? Technological culture can actively cultivate our worst impulses so that we value things only insofar as they serve our ends, which means that we don't value them at all, we value only ourselves. And yet, ironically, in so doing, we devalue ourselves also. I am totally obsessed with this. I really can't figure out how serious I am about this, but I do always say that there is something really interesting about the fact that all the most desirable possessions in our culture are things called an iPad, an iPod, an iMac. Marketers are very astute, right? We excel at saying I. Third, a prominent conservative economist once said one of the most insightful things I've ever heard anyone say. In this world, there are no solutions. There are only trade-offs. This is something that political conservatives are extremely good at remembering about social policy, where liberals sometimes harbor utopian fantasies. It is also, by the way, something conservatives are extremely bad at remembering about things like a market economy, meaning that that too can have negative consequences, like any other human construct. That every move we make has another side to it. In other words, technology and technological culture may help us solve certain human problems, but it or we will likely create new ones along the way. Take but one example borrowed from the philosopher David Lowen. The mechanization of food production, right, has enabled us to feed more and more people. It has also had rather grave environmental consequences. Nuclear energy may provide humanity with limitless energy if it does not end up destroying us first, and so on. We find solutions and they make new problems. Fourth, technological culture may lead us to excel at means, even as it makes us completely clueless how to talk about ends. What is it for? What is it that we're trying to achieve? As the Christian theologian Paul Tillich wonderfully puts it, technical reason provides means for ends but offers no guidance at all in the determination of ends. That is why science and technology can never displace religion, philosophy, and ethics. And if we hear Nobel Prize-winning scientists claiming otherwise, it just shows how little they understand about philosophy. Right? The notion that science renders philosophy and ethics unnecessary, I mean, I have trouble figuring out how to even engage that as a serious position. Technology, in other words, can help us with the how, but it can never really answer the questions of what to do, and maybe even more crucially, what not to do, and under what limits. Technology never has an answer to the question of where to stop. There is no technological reason not to clone human beings. There are moral reasons, there are philosophical reasons, there are theological reasons. There are no technological reasons. Technology can never answer its own questions in that way. Or put it better, technology doesn't even ask that question. Technology is, at that level, just a means at our disposal. And then finally, one of technology's greatest, technological culture's greatest dangers is that it focuses us on that which can be measured, defined, quantified. And in doing that, it arguably crowds out what philosophers like to call the depth dimension of human experience. So I can be connected to other people. But am I connected to them? I ask you that about my 3,000 Facebook friends. I have a sense of like what my high school friend's kid looks like. I have no sense of the world of my high school friend. The depth dimension of human experience is erased in a technological culture. Or in more theological language, it runs the risk of blinding us to that which transcends empirical measurement, which for Judaism is another way of saying to the things that matter most. So, technology will not be our savior, nor need it be our destroyer. Human ambivalence about technology is as old as technology itself. Witness Genesis 4, where the people create their own culture, music, metallurgy, and then end up murdering each other. And perhaps that's as it should be. If we harness it to the good, then the early Soloveitchik promises we can create worlds. But if we use it for evil, or just as bad, if we allow it to limit our horizons and distort our vision of how we're meant to live in the world, then, as Heschel warns, we will destroy the worlds that Soloveitchik invited us to create. Thank you very much. I'm happy to take impossible questions, which always happens here. Thank you. It's like a round of three. Please.
If a rabbi were to speak about this 500 years ago, couldn't you replace the word technology with home or apartment? That the home, focusing on having a home, is going to keep us from connecting, it's going to separate us? And so my question, the basis of my question is, aren't you almost asking the question of materialism versus values, or can versus should? And so you're using the word technology, but it's really something much broader that is the subject you're really focusing on.
Okay, I'll try to fumble around that. Yeah.
You mentioned several times the problem isn't technology, but the way it causes us to think and change the way that we think and behave. But I wonder to what extent certain technologies make it sort of inevitable for what I'm thinking in certain ways. The only way to avoid falling into that thought pattern is to abandon that technology entirely. Or is there a way to, like, how does one go about making use of technologies that maybe can just push you into thinking in these destructive ways without doing so, and is that even possible?
It's a really hard question. Yeah, please.
Driverless cars have a much less error of getting crashes, so people won't die as much, so they'll be doing good. And I wonder where in your talk how you would think about that.
Can you give me another sentence about what that question really is? Like, what is it that you're driving at in that question?
To what extent should we be using all the technology that we
use? Oh, God. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's hard about many questions that immediately result from a topic like this is it's where philosophers and experts in social policy ideally ought to talk to each other. Where philosophers are often impatient with people who do social policy, and social policy people are often too busy thinking that philosophers have nothing useful to say. So the question you ask is actually very hard. Now, first, Herb's question about home and apartment as opposed to technology. So one thing I would say about that is I think you could argue that my talk is not about technology, but about uncomplicated notions of progress. Where this is kind of one of, you know, liberal modernity's sins is the illusion that, like, you know, we're constantly getting better. There are all kinds of versions of this, more and less subtle. I think you could make that claim. I think what Heschel would want to argue, and in a different way Heidegger argues, is that while that may be true, technology amplifies it to such an extent that it becomes a difference in kind and not merely a degree. Whether that's right or that's wrong on some level is a judgment call. But I think you can say that about lots of things, right? It's not like, you know, the creation of new tools eliminates old jobs. It also makes lots of things possible. Right? So we have, I mean, one of the problems we have in our incredibly non-dialectical culture is we have some people who scream their head off, right, saying, you know, but wait, if we do this, we'll have the following destructive consequences. And then we have other people who say, destructive consequences? What are you talking about? Right? We're the only advanced democracy that has a major political party that insists that, like, climate change is a fiction. Right? That's a theological crisis. Right? It is a refusal to acknowledge the depth of human agency or the complexity of human agency. Right? That's actually what that is. I said not in some partisan way. I just think it's fascinating. It's fascinating that a party so deeply influenced by religion, right, makes that claim. Because it's a refusal to sort of wrestle with the depth of human agency. So not to mention, by the way, a religion that has focused a tremendous amount of attention on human depravity. Like for a party deeply influenced by Christianity to insist that there are no limits, no consequences to human agency is at least a fascinating question for a social historian. How quite does that happen? Right? There's a lot to say there. And again, I don't mean this as some partisan argument. I think it's really interesting to try and understand what's going on there. Now, about materialism and values, so yes, I mean, going back to the book of Deuteronomy, right? Sefer Dvarim is obsessed with the question, what's going to happen when you have lots of stuff? On some level, that is basically the preoccupation of Sefer Dvarim. I'm going to take you to this land. I'm going to give you lots of stuff, much of it you didn't build. And then you know what's going to happen? You're going to become monsters. And then I'm going to have to send you out again. I mean, really, that's the dilemma of Dvarim, which is what happens when blessings become curses? That's the theological dilemma. What happens when, yes, you know what? There's all this stuff you can have, you can use it, you can make your life better. But you could also become a monster. And knowing you, I think you might. No, I mean, that's just a shot of the book of Deuteronomy, right? I don't think that's some grand interpretation of mine. That's the dilemma, right? So materialism and values, the issue, I think, Dvarim is extremely focused, it seems to me, on what it sees as two sort of antitheses to genuine spiritual life. One is a sense of entitlement, and the other is a sense of acquisitiveness, right? Acquisitive meaning I want to possess it. Because what does Dvarim say, right? Deuteronomy 15, which is in many people argue the core chapter of Dvarim, right? Open your hand. The NRSV translation wonderfully translates verse in Dvarim, right? Be neither tight-fisted nor hard-hearted. That's the dilemma of acquisitiveness that materialism, I don't know what to say here, creates, foments, comes hand in hand with. That sentence is beyond my pay grade, how to really finish that sentence. But that's the dilemma. And technology, so the argument would go, technological culture amplifies that urge to possess. Right? I mean, one of the great arguments of, I think, one of the great arguments of Tanakh is that many of the things we think we possess, we don't possess at all. Right? Like, it's fascinating. Here, I want to say something that's going to, all kinds of people are going to go crazy. I have a feeling. But I just want to say this, I'm saying this as an intellectual historian, right? The notion in secular Zionism that the Jewish people have a right to the land of Israel would strike Devarim, and this is not some crazy left-wing argument. I'm just trying to understand Devarim for a second. Would strike Sefer Devarim as crazy. You don't have a right to anything. It's a divine grace. I give it to you. You don't have a right to it. Now, you could say Tanakh in general is not focused on rights discourse, for better and for worse. It's focused on responsibility discourse. Right? So there's like a lot to say there. A lot of the ways that we conventionally think are deeply unbiblical. Right? You could argue, great, we don't live in biblical times. I don't want to sort of fight that out, but I think it's actually really important to wrestle with that. And we should also, as I say, every time I teach anything, we should also avoid walking away thinking that was a really amazing dismantling of what other people think. Because everyone has their own versions of this. Right? Entitlement is not the province only of people I don't like. Right? No, I think it's really important because that's how poisonous and toxic our discourse really is. Right? Every spiritual criticism becomes, right? I've told this joke in this space before, but I think it is the best Jewish joke of all time. Right? The rabbi gives this amazing Yom Kippur drasha where he obliterates the people for their hypocrisy, their acquisitiveness. They're just impossible. And at the end of the Musaf, the entire community is lined up to congratulate them. They all say the same thing. Yashar Koach, Rabbi, you really told them. That's a very profound joke. I mean, you laugh, but it's actually, by the way, that's us. So I want to be careful about that. Now, your question is actually very powerful. You know, can we abandon technological culture without abandoning technology? So on one level, I would want to give you a very simple-minded answer. It's too late. Meaning we're not abandoning technology. The real question is there some way that we can recover spirit in the midst of a technological society? Is there some way where we can reprioritize ways of talking and thinking that we have completely lost? One of the ways is obviously is, you know, the vineyard in which I toil, to just be unnecessarily pretentious, right? The place where I live, right, is to ask the question, can we restore religious traditions as calls to us to be kinder, gentler, and more generous, as opposed to gifts to give yourself, as yoga studios all over Manhattan, you know, distort a thousands-year-old spiritual tradition about connecting to being and being willing to serve, becomes give yourself a gift, right? That's really important stuff, right? Can we restore that kind of language? The answer is, I don't know. But I have a feeling that we are headed for very bad, well, probably already in very bad places if we don't find a way to do that. Does it have to be religion? Probably not. I mean, Heschel probably thought it had to be religion. We could talk about why that is. But some other way of talking seems to me to be urgently necessary. Now, I lost the last question. What was the last question? Oh, because I didn't totally understand it. It was something about Uber. No, it was about driverless cars. I mean, the only question that I think a philosopher, the only answer a philosopher gives to that question is, right, I think, it is clear that there are powers that we have that we should not use, and powers that we have that it would be totally irresponsible not to use. And life is essentially about sorting out which of those two things are. Techno-utopians, this is totally not fair, but, you know, tend to emphasize one question, and techno-skeptics, to make up a word, tend to emphasize only the other. But the truth, as always, is about rubbing those questions up against each other. I don't know enough about driverless cars to answer that question. But I'm going to leave it at that, because that's just, you know, it's beyond my ability. That's too concrete for my abstract mind. Go ahead. Yeah, please.
So I was surprised at how angry or contemptful maybe Heschel was vis-a-vis technology, because I would also think that technology is a means to amp, to use your word, awe, like a telescope, or, you know, using
right.
the ability to code the human genome and say, oh my God, look how amazing, whether you believe in God or not, this is.
Yeah, so I think that to some degree, I mean, this is going to sound like a very funny formulation. I think the Holocaust registers deeply for Heschel much earlier than it registers for Soloveitchik. And so what animates him at that time is that's his narrative of essentially what creates, what makes possible the utter devaluation of human life. He thinks at the end of the day that that's technological culture. Is that fair? It's more complicated than that. But he's engaged in a polemical project, right? He's trying to shake people. By the way, it's amazing. What's amazing about it is 1955, right? There was no I anything then. I mean, imagine how far we've gone in the wrong direction from his perspective since that time. I mean, it's an astonishing claim. So I think the anger is on some level, and this is what makes him so different from Heidegger, is the obsession with what he sees as the moral consequences of this. The moral consequences of this are, here's another example. Forget about whether I would obliterate people. Your suffering makes no claim on me. Why is that interesting? Right? One of Heschel's great phrases, he says, you know, modern man is callous to catastrophes. People are obliterated. People die. What's for breakfast? Or worse, the sort of liberal humanism that says, you know, I feel good about myself because I felt bad about myself this morning. Right? You know, and I think you would say, like, there's something about that that's just really lazy. And it is part of a culture that thinks the value of things is how they serve me. This doesn't make any impact on me, so why does it matter? Now, I would say, is that too simple? Yes, it is too simple. By the way, look, you could say to Heschel, the way of wonder and the way of expediency, what about everybody else who's just some amalgam of the two? Right? What about us? To which I think Heschel would say, look, you know, at a certain point, you lay out a stark choice when you desperately need to move people. Right? When Psalm 1 says, there are two ways to be in the world. There's Derech Rasha'im, the way of the wicked, and there's Derech Tzadikim, the way of the righteous. Every time I read that Psalm, I always think, what about me? What about Derech Beinonim? Like, what about, like, just people? I am not horrible. I am also the farthest thing from a saint. The voice you heard in the background was my wife nodding her head. Now, what about like everything in between? But the way wisdom literature in Tanakh works, and I think Heschel, consciously or not, is in that mode, is to say, no. Stop driving me crazy with all the gray stuff in the middle for a minute. I'm going to lay out the choices you face so you can actually wrestle with this question instead of contentedly saying, oh, I live in the gray space. Because you know what? You probably, the more you just contentedly say you live in the gray space, you shade darker and darker all the time. Because you don't ask yourself, how can I get closer to that side? Right? So yeah, it is more complicated. But again, I think this is very much a post-Holocaust. At the same time that Heschel is really writing post-Holocaust Jewish thought, in that sense, Soloveitchik is not there yet. I think that happens later, which is just interesting. You know, people, this is a fascinating debate among American historians of American Judaism, sort of the process by which American Jews began to wrestle with the Holocaust at all, right? The argument always was, you know, oh, Elie Wiesel writes Night. But wait a minute, 20 years have passed. Now that's kind of, people are arguing that's not really true, it was happening earlier. But, trauma is kind of like that. Very few people wake up the day after a devastating trauma and say, let's talk about what this meant in my life. Right? They're busy trying to feel, they're busy wrestling with numbness. So Heschel is just there earlier. And does he overstate his case? He might. But I think he thinks, you know what, in a world where everyone understates this case, I would like to overstate it consciously and intentionally. How am I doing on time? Okay. Nachum, I'll take a round and then evade them.
I think there's a risk in trying to align, as brilliantly as you did this evening, two topics. One, the monster in the room, the gorilla in the room called technology.
Mm-hmm.
And two, brilliant theologians, Rabbi Heschel and Rabbi Soloveitchik, and trying to then intersect them on the topic. Because a simple solution, too simple, at the end of the movie, they both recognize technology as that monster, each in his own way. Rabbi Heschel writes a book called The Sabbath, in which that really becomes his philosophical, you know this better than I, his treatment of this technology in his acknowledgement, ultimately, there is mystery out there, but God's the creator, we're the creator. So the antidote becomes human agency in the acknowledgement for man to recognize that it's finite. Similarly, you know, Rav Soloveitchik, in any number of his writings, even in Isha Lafa, would say that the antidote again becomes human agency, overpowered by technology, but the ultimate submission is subjugation, maybe too strong a word, to God's will. So that when the two things come into conflict with one and the other, as we've seen in any number of his writings, ultimately Rav Soloveitchik can say, I submit. The same way that Rabbi Heschel might say, I am the creator.
Okay, there's a lot I can say in response to that. I'm going to get there. Okay. Yeah, please.
What troubles me about this question of whether humans should use their capacity to reach beyond themselves to acquire more is it feels like it's a question being asked by us in this room and a general culture of people who have all their needs met. And what about people who don't have their needs met and need acquisitiveness in order to survive? And further, what about the property of technology which connects us to other people and makes us aware of the struggle of others who are denigrated or oppressed? That personally, saying in my life, I was not aware of a lot of things, and coming into social media and technology at an age when most people come into maturity, I was able to see the struggles of other people. I don't know, this actually sounds a little selfish now, but perhaps like that also is a faculty of technology, and I would like to know.
Right, great. Anyone want to ask an easy question?
It's not an easy question.
Leave that to me to decide. Go ahead. No.
So my question is how Soloveitchik's comments in number one, the first source and the second source, where he talks about how Halakha Man wants to see the ideal Halakha actualized, and in the second source where he talks about it being a very activist fulfillment of that, comports with his relatively non-messianic view of Zionism, especially compared to the Zionism of Ralph Cook and others.
Okay.
And secondly, I guess more broadly, how we sort of strike the right balance between the total pacifism of the Satmar Rebbe and the sort of activism that sort of threatens people, the world in flames, you know.
Why don't you break it down? It's an easy question.
Yeah, exactly. This is a tough crowd. Okay. So. Nachum, I'm not totally sure I understood everything you said, but I wanted to pick up on one piece of it, which is your suggestion. I know this wasn't your main point, but I think it's actually very fascinating to draw this out, that at the end of the day, Heschel and Soloveitchik share a sense that one of the cures for technological culture is a willingness to submit to God. I think that there is something deeply true about that for both of them, and yet what they mean by submission is radically different, because Heschel never once countenances the possibility that submission to God involves or permits the sacrifice of my own ethical sensibilities and intuitions. In fact, what it means to sacrifice to God for Heschel is to give up my impulse to behave immorally and hurt other people. Soloveitchik on this question is much more complicated, as you well know, right? Where consciously or not, one of his responses to modernity, and I think in particular the ethical challenges to Jewish tradition raised by modernity, is to move into his later Akedah mode, where one of the things a person does is sacrifice his capacity for reasoning, which includes moral reasoning. Heschel would never have countenanced that as a possibility because he thought that that form of religion was extremely dangerous. The way that I would say that, which I don't mean this as an attack on Soloveitchik, I just think it's a big problem, is I hear this all the time when students come to talk to me about some of their traumas with some of their teachers in early life. It's how willing some teachers are to make an akedat of other people's life. Which is just enormously painful. And I don't think, I think Soloveitchik was far more morally sensitive than that, but I do think some of what he says makes that possible, right? So the question is not for a religious thinker whether you think submission is important. It's what is the texture of that submission? What are you submitting to, and what are you submitting about? My colleague Ethan Tucker says this really beautifully, right? That he thinks the history of halakha is filled with the idea of surrendering my id, but never surrendering my superego, which I think Heschel would have, signed that sentence very clearly. Soloveitchik, much less so. So the dialectic is very different in each of their cases. Now, your question, there's a lot to talk about there. I have talked a lot over the years in writing and in, various contexts about gratitude, and specifically about how I think gratitude comes inextricably intertwined with generosity. I also think it's important to say, as I've started saying more and more, that one ought to be careful not to imply that the only theological starting place for a religious person is gratitude, lest you sound like a theologian of white, male, rich privilege. That in other words, you also have to talk about another theological starting place, which is a theological starting place in how Bereishit Rabba imagines Avraham. Theology begins with protest. The world is not supposed to be this way. Right? That famous image in Bereishit Rabba of Abraham seeing what probably translates as an apartment building, but we usually translate it as a palace, right? That is not a palace lit up. That is a total mistranslation of the Hebrew word doleket, right? It means that Abraham is walking around and he sees a palace in flames. And there's something about his willingness to say, wait a minute, that's not the way this is supposed to be, that moves God to reveal God's self to Abraham. So I would say that gratitude and protest, or if you want, gratitude and a certain kind of indignation, must go hand in hand, lest we either just walk around angry and self-righteous, or, hey, everything's wonderful, I have everything, right? So there always has to be, I think, anytime you have a religious claim that, you can't have a religious life without X, I think it is almost always, right? I want to underline that almost, the case, that you also have to make space for the opposite. So that's one piece. Now, I would say something about, you said about, do the poor have to be, people who aren't privileged have acquisitiveness? To me, the answer to that is no. That's not what acquisitiveness is. Acquisitiveness is, right, the posture of mine. I'll tell you something really sort of interesting. In the world of academic Bible scholarship, what I find totally fascinating, which is the argument that, based on the prophets, that the mitzvah of lo tachmod, do not covet, is almost exclusively directed to the rich who have, rather than the poor who don't. You already have a lot, don't insist on hogging more and more. You have, now I forget, someone has photographic memory of Tanakh, which perek this is, where one of the prophets, is it Micha? Who talks about the powerful are chomdim batim. They covet the houses of everybody else. And it's the rich people who do that. That's the kind of covetous. The covetous that says never enough, not I need food for my children. So I think Tanakh is actually very clear on this point, right? It's about greed. It's not about sustenance. Now, you raised one other question I think is actually very moving, which is, yes, technology makes us aware of things we used to have the luxury of not being aware of. What I spend a lot of time thinking about, and to be honest, I really have no idea how to think about this, I find myself very stuck with this question, is how much does that move us in big ways as opposed to in immediate ways? Right? We write checks reflexively. I'm not sure. I mean, yes, if we are sharing what we have in ways that we otherwise would not have shared, that's a good thing. But, you know, does that really lead us to think about what are the most effective and efficient ways to help? I'm not sure. It's very, very hard. This is why, you know, one of the other things I talk about all the time is empathy. I think it's extremely important not to be confused about what empathy can't do. Empathy cannot solve difficult policy questions. Empathy can invest you in the question in the first place. Because otherwise, you'll just be totally reactive. But how can I not give? I mean, did you see her? And that does have moral weight, but it doesn't have all the moral weight. So some philosophers, psychologist at Yale, Paul Bloom, is like a very extreme version of this, who basically says, yes, that's why empathy is worthless, because it doesn't answer any of our questions. Well, it depends what your questions are, right? If it means I don't want anyone who has Alzheimer's and no one to visit them, if I want someone to sit with people, empathy answers that question very deeply. What empathy doesn't answer is, what's the best way to take care of people when they've lost all their faculty, when they've outlived their minds? What do I do? Empathy doesn't really answer. I mean, it helps, but it's not an answer. It's a piece, right? So, yeah, I think that technology can amp up a certain kind of attentiveness. By the way, even as it can oversaturate. It's hard. I mean, this issue is really, I think, complicated and hard. Now, the last sort of lighthearted question about Zionism. Why was Soloveitchik not a messianic Zionist? I don't really know the answer to that question. I suspect that in part he thought that that was a very dangerous proposition. He thought that the politicization, call this whichever one you want, the politicization of religion or the religionization of politics would have disastrous consequences. One of the most interesting moments in Soloveitchik's public career that is celebrated by some and actively ignored by others is a moment in the 1970s, I believe, when Soloveitchik is asked by a reporter at Ma'ariv, what is your position on land for peace? Soloveitchik's answer is sort of amazing. He says, I'm not quite sure I understand why you're asking me that. I'm a rabbi. Why don't you ask me to know something about security? Like, from where should I answer that question? I'm not an expert on any of the questions you're raising. It's such a disarming, amazing, and what it is a stunning critique of what's beginning to form around Tzvi Yehuda Cook, right? Which is like the sense that that every question is a halachic question, right? And through a particular halachic theological lens. Right? Soloveitchik is very nervous about that. Now, how prescient is that? I don't really know. I mean, I'm not sure. Because I think what underlies your question is fascinating is there is the ample material in Soloveitchik whereby he could have become a messianic Zionist. I do think the sentence I said does explain why he became a Zionist, which is if you have the chance to actually implement certain Jewish dreams, not to mention to fulfill the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh, of saving lives, you got to do it. But he was very wary of the messianic piece of this. And also extremely focused on the ways that he felt that religion needed to be, even as it validated certain forms of political power, it also always needed to critique them. I mean, one of his other interesting political actions, which is also sort of a fascinating moment, is when, after Sabra and Shatila, he writes a letter to Begin, if I remember correctly, and he basically says, and at the time he's the president of Mizrahi in America, the religious Zionist America, and he says, I just want to make it clear, if there is not a full commission that is totally independent to report on what happened in Sabra and Shatila, I will resign from Mizrahi and I will never again say a positive word about Zionism again. I will not do it. It's your decision. And there is about, I think, a certain understanding of, right, religion on some level, theology might argue for why in certain moments people need to embrace power, but religion always has to also be a critique of power. Right? I would say, you know, in post-Holocaust Jewish ethics, right, the Shoah always has to work in two ways in that way, to legitimate and necessitate Jewish power and to critique it at the same time. We live in a time, it goes without saying, where many Jews, if not most Jews, have decided to learn one of those lessons and not the other. That's oversimplified, but it's not that oversimplified, right? So I think Soloveitchik is actually, not surprisingly, for someone who's obsessed with dialectics, he's very dialectic in this way. Yes, we'll go there, but we also have to be kind of true to the values that he understands. And there was a second part of your question that I forgot. I'm sorry.
It was just a general question about the right balance between passive or active.
Yeah, so that's, on some level, you're just restating the question that I was suggesting is, the reason you can all walk away totally frustrated is, I didn't actually answer the question of when should we use power and when should we not. At minimum, what I'm trying to do is restore to the table the possibility of realizing that steering that course is exactly the religious mandate of human power. Not to refuse it and not to worship it. And that's hard. It is always easier to embrace one point. It is always easier to be a hyper-nationalist or a pacifist. It's consistent. I think they're also both morally treacherous and quite problematic. But the other option is to live inside the mud of, wait, on a case-by-case basis, I got to figure this out. And that's really hard. Contemporary Jewish discourse does not give you hope for the possibility of people to talk things through in that way. Right? It's really hard. There's a lot to say about that, right? This is maybe the wrong way to end, but something that I have been obsessed with for the last few months is trying to figure out whether, like Jews, we congratulate ourselves in certain ways in that we also think we're worse than everybody else. Like we're better than everybody else, we're also worse than everybody else, right? There is some way in which I think that's actually fascinatingly true in some like almost raw psychological way. And I've been trying to figure out, like as I was watching the sort of like, horrific discourse around the Iran deal in the American Jewish community, so is this something that's wrong with us, or are we just reflective of what's currently wrong with America? Because it's not like, I'm going to stop following America on the Iran deal. Instead, I'll look at how Republicans talk about Obama and how leftists talk about Republicans, right? Instead I'll read about how liberals talked about George W. Bush, because that'll make me feel better about discourse, right? In other words, I find that question really interesting. To what extent is this like a Jewish problem? It's a post-Holocaust problem. It's a trauma problem of the Jews. And to what extent is that like, no, Americans can't talk about anything right now, and we're living in America. I really don't know what the answer is to that question. Probably the answer is a little bit of both. But, to find ways to actually talk about how almost all of the questions that matter are actually messy. Which means that political ideologues are almost always unhelpful. It's hard. It's very, very hard. And I think that that's part of, it's a funny way, but one of the great human powers, which you don't even think about that way, is the power of speech. And what kind of speech do we create? What kind of world do we create with our speech? That's like a huge, right? A huge, huge question. Is that a uniquely modern problem? Are we doing? I've often talked about this. Is Jewish discourse worse now than it was? I don't know. At a certain point, Hasidim and Mitznagdim made up because they realized they had a common enemy called the Haskalah and modernity, right? But I don't know. I'm just really not sure. But I do think that there's something about the refusal of messiness and complicatedness that is really actually quite destructive and devastating. And that's exactly what this asks for. This asks for the realization that we will use power and we ought to use power, and that there will be dangerous moral consequences of that.